Roger Williams University is hosting a crisis management seminar on May 3rd at their Providence campus. Crises, whether a natural disaster, cyber attack, or financial instability, can have severe repercussions if not handled properly. This is where crisis management plays a pivotal role. Join Roger Williams MBA students and expert speakers to learn how to prepare for the unexpected. The program is totally free and open to the public. You can register online at rwu.edu/events/crisis-management-symposium.
This is the Bartholomew Town Podcast.
The legalization of recreational cannabis that went into effect last year can open doors for your career. If you are already in the industry or wondering what is the best path to break into the cannabis field, well, the University of Rhode Island has a program to help you become highly competitive in numerous areas of the cannabis industry. Fully accredited by URI's College of Pharmacy, the certificate program is 100% online, and it can be completed in 2 semesters. The next application deadline for the summer 2023 session is April 4th, and courses start on May 9th. You can learn more at uri.edu/online/cannabis or give them a call at 401-874-5280. So today we are really kind of beginning what will be at least a monthly focus on the craft of songwriting and music, particularly here in Rhode Island. And joining us for the first installment of this, I guess we'll call it a series, micro series within the show, is Keith McCurdy of Voodoo Sister. And someone who's produced several excellent records right out of Providence. You've been at it for a while, and you've kind of had this journey of, at least from the outside, it seems like you've kind of landed in a really interesting place right now. And we were talking about this just a second ago before we started rolling, that a lot of people don't have a concept of the working musician, the working kind of middle class artist. And being in that space of carving out your own path, your own identity, and finding a way to, you know, continue to create art and also not just survive, but build a life for yourself. I guess talk about that, because you were really onto something interesting right before we started rolling.
Right. Yeah. Not just survive, thrive. And you can't thrive if you can't survive. Voodoo Sister has been, it's 12 years old now. Right now we're working on what will be our fifth album. I've normally, like most people who grew up poor who picked up a guitar, you make it work by, you work horrible jobs over and over again. You get fired, you leave them, you get hired, you get fired. And that was my life for a long time. This last year was the first year that I actually quit a full-time job and have been doing music full time. So in my 20 plus years of performing on stage, writing songs and being in bands, this was year one, like, of being a real, in my opinion, like a real productive working artist. So that's exciting.
Yeah. I mean, it's a huge shift, and it's like, I mean, it's not that you weren't out there before. Like I know you were on tour and you were doing it,
I worked more than full time. You know, I used to work in group homes, and those are, I mean, that job sucked the soul out of me. But, you know, I would work 50, 60, 70 hours a week, not because I wanted to either. A lot of it was forced overtime. And then I had chosen to go back to school to get my degree, and doing that full time, in addition to still performing, still writing, still producing work. And it probably left a significant scar on my psyche.
Yeah. Well, it's hard to form an identity when you're back and forth between, you know, a space, whether it's work or whatever, that it's just, you have to kind of shut down to make money. Like that's a really hard thing to do.
You shut down a significant part of what makes you who you are. I mean, you know, with talking about creative types, it's like, when you really make art and this is what you do, it's like, it isn't just, I mean, I talk about it in the sense of like, yeah, I want my career to be this, but it's also just like, it's a calling. I mean, you can't not do it. And I mean, I placated people in my life that like, they just wouldn't understand that. And like, you know, you tell people things like, yeah, I guess I'll just be a teacher. Nothing wrong with that, but it's just like I never wanted to be a teacher, and I tell people that. I used to tell people that. It's like, well, you know, because if you say like, well, I'm a musician, I'm not trying to be. I am a musician, and I've been doing this for a long time, and it's like you get the typical response from people, because as we were talking about earlier, how like people have a really hard concept to think about like working class, middle class musicians. It's like you're either not one or you're really rich and famous, and that's like the only standard that people seem to have a lot of the times. And I think that's just not a good, healthy way to think about it.
Yeah, it's also it gets narrow. It's like a pyramid that is narrower and narrower as you get to the towards the quote unquote top in terms of like wealth or anything like that. Like there really are only 500, maybe 1,000 acts that are like in the world, in not just American music, like internationally speaking, that are really at that like active level and that are in that huge money coming in type of scenario. Yeah. Most acts that people like, unless all you do is listen to,
and they're not all great.
And a lot of them are either basically actors or actresses that are kind of just performing a designed, some people will say mind control, some people
the corporate manufactured put together, you know, and people buy it. It's like, oh, it's somebody's kid who they just decided to enter them into like, you know, voice contests and stuff, and
yeah,
someone's some rich person's kid or whatever, I don't know.
It's a totally different world being you can call it indie, you can call it whatever you want, but it's a different path. And that's where, as I was growing up, you know, and I'm sure for you as well, like a lot of the artists that you really love either lived in that space full time or at one point occupied that space as they were really maybe making some of their best art.
Yeah. I mean, you and I grew up in the 90s. So it's interesting how like MTV was like the apex of like, if you got an MTV, man, oh, you made it. And what was cool then too, is like, I really trying to move away from this, like, oh, this nostalgia guy thing that I'm so guilty of, but it was cool though to be, that was my awakening for music though. So it was like watching bands who were like, they were people who came from poor neighborhoods like me and like poor families, a lot of them, not all of them, but like Kurt Cobain certainly was. And it was just like these alternative rock bands who came from the underground and made it big. You don't see that as much anymore. It's like a lot of real, on that level, it's like a lot of really corporate put together stuff. And that's always been there. But I mean, there was just a big movement back then of independent bands actually getting successful. And that was pretty inspiring.
Wait, it's super inspiring. And you think about, for me, it was like WBRU and then like late night WRIU, like just that. Yeah. In fact, I have a BRU sticker on my wall from back then, just to like remind like that process and like that organic moment that really from like maybe 94 to like 97, a buddy and I were talking about this a couple of weeks ago, how like when Smash Mouth or Candlebox, there was like a moment where BRU kind of shifted and you were like, oh, it's over, or it's going to be over soon. You know what I mean?
I know exactly what you're talking about. I mean, it went from hearing like Pornoful Pyros and like Soundgarden and like Riot Girl bands to like, what the fuck just happened?
Yeah, totally. It really shifted out from under itself. And that was like the beginning of this amalgamation of pop. Yeah,
the pop punk thing started in ska and whatever. Or, I don't know, some of those genres that were coming out in the late 90s. It's like, okay, all right, I'm all set with this.
Yeah, it could appear on a compilation comfortably with Backstreet Boys.
That's around the time that I started to get into classical music a lot.
Smart play. You just remastered and reissued an excellent record, Bastard Children, which is... You know, talk about that decision making process to like actually go back in and reissue a record that is now 10 years old.
Yeah. So sometimes I feel like when artists do that, it's like a bad sign, but or it's just some cut. Well, if it's a big artist, it's usually a money grab. Look, it's the 35th anniversary. We're going to re-release it again. But no, well, this was like Bastard Children. Like I'd been playing music for over 20 years. I had never done an album before for a lot of reasons, but for beyond my control. But like when I started Voodoo Sister, it was important to me. So first of all, the sister started as a project for me because I've been in and out of bands. I used to only just sing. I didn't play guitar, and occasionally I'd write my own song completely on a guitar. But like normally, they were always collaborative efforts, which is how I used to like to work. I still do, but after being in and out of so many bands, you get in a band, you write a bunch of songs together, you feel great about, and then the band breaks up, and then you got to start from scratch again. Voodoo Sister started exclusively for the reason that, like, I wanted something where it could be a band, but if people leave, I still have my work, and I can still continue, and I can still be this entity. So then it was important to me that, like, I want to record an album because I never put one out before. So that's when I did Bastard Children with Greg Holmes, a good friend of mine, and in his basement, and it was a wonderful summer. But you know, when those came in, my first album, I was 25, 26 or something, and I literally cried when those CDs came in the mail, because it's like it was such a big deal for me. So it wasn't really my idea to remix and remaster it. Michael Samos is the one who we were working with a song from that album that we were changing around for a project, and he had the master of the song, and he was like, you know, I'd love to take a stab in remixing and remastering this, because you know he played on it and he helped kind of produce a little bit of it too, and he has the tools to do it. So I was like, well, all right, if you think you can do it, that'd be great, because I wanted to do something special for the 10th anniversary. I thought maybe we could just do a show, but I thought it was really wonderful that Mike was able to do that, and it sounds great and really brings new life to it. But you know, it's a special album. It's also the only album that I actually like. No, it's the only album I make any like little bit of passive income with. For some reason, a few songs on that album were playlisted on Spotify, and like since then, it's given me a tiny little bit of pay a couple of bills with money.
Yeah.
Which is pretty cool. So I still get people from like different countries. Like they want to, they keep telling, they'll reach out to me telling me how much they like Psalms, the song Psalms. But yeah, so you know, it's interesting the journey that album has had,
Yeah, it's
because
fascinating when it gets playlisted years later, or it's
yeah.
continues to grow. It's like a mysterious, Spotify is such a mysterious entity in so many ways, you know?
I chalk that up too, because the year after we played the only time we ever did it, we played the Newport Folk Festival, and I think they must have been put on a playlist shortly. I don't know. I really don't know how that happened. If I could figure that out, I would. I wish I could figure that out,
Yeah, do it every time.
because I mean, there's a lot. I have a lot more work since then.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of typical. I think anybody feels this way about their music. It's like, you know, I wrote those songs like 12 years ago. It's like, oh, I have new stuff, you know. That's actually, I would think, is much better, but I'm grateful though. I'm very grateful for what the album has done. Though, you
Yeah.
know, even if it's modest, but so
Yeah, I remember that year, of course, that you played the folk festival, and
yeah, because you had a Me and Dan Blakes to stay in your apartment in Queens. That was very kind of you.
we
We
played a
played a
couple
house
of
show,
shows,
and
yeah. And then and that was an interesting year at the folk festival, because it was like, you know, there was still a significant, not over the top, but it was I remember the Rice Cakes playing. I'm pretty sure Lasgo Tooth performed. And it was kind of like, all right, that was like my favorite part of that year's festival, was that stage and
yeah.
hanging out there, and like Brian Minto like wandering around or whatever, and you know, just like
Yeah.
this because it was legitimate in the sense that if you were from Oklahoma and you came to the folk festival and you walked in, you wouldn't have gone like, oh, these guys are like the local artists. It just happened to be that you were from Rhode Island, and that was like
Yeah.
such a magical. Things were really magical at that point in Rhode Island in an interesting way.
Yeah.
And it feels
Definitely.
like we're due for another era of just magic and activity, and like the right people and the right bands and the right listeners and everybody kind of coming together around something. Do you sense that too?
I think so. with just speaking for myself, it's like, I mean, I'm older now and I'm much different, and I've learned a lot of different things, mostly through mistakes. And there's a confidence I have now that I didn't really when I was starting the like Voodoo Sister especially. So it's interesting. The kind of performances I've been navigating through and the kind of choices I've been making have been more deliberate and thoughtful, I think. And yeah, I think we're overdue for that. Hopefully something unexpected, unpredictable.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Especially considering, you know, it's a lot of different genres too that are seem to be coming together, and that's pretty nice. I think getting too stuck on a particular genre is unhealthy.
Completely unhealthy. That's the one thing that I really would love to see in Providence that in my time in Brooklyn was really prevalent was you'd have shows. I just played one on New Year's Eve or the day before when you were playing at Askew. I had a show where basically I was the only white artist on the bill, the only singer-songwriter on the bill. And it was incredible. Like, because you have an amalgamation of like really performance, experimental stuff, a bunch of hip hop artists, and then kind of a singer-songwriter, folk, indie, alternative act. And people's attention spans can handle that. And it just feels more magical than like, all right, here's like seven dudes with guitars, like kind of playing
I
alt
mean,
country.
even like something that I mean, it's Voodoo Sister for a reason. And something that was always important to me was anytime I was putting a bill together, I really think for me, it's just a personal sticking point. Like I try to have a bill that has women on it. I think that's really important to me. And it's like not, I mean, if it's like I'm not going to select someone if I don't think it's good music, but it is really important to me to get like women on the bill, for example. I really cannot stand going to a show and it's just a bunch of white dudes, poorly dressed white dudes with guitars again. And it's like, this is so boring. Even I'm sick of that, you know, and I grew up listening to bands like that, but it's like, you know, I mean, most of my musical heroes are actually women. So it's like, I really do like the, that perspective, in art.
I couldn't agree more. In fact, there's nothing worse to me than ending up either on a bill or in an environment where there's a bunch of guys from New England wearing, other than Dan Blakeslee, because he's the one person who's like the OG on this, and it's like he's like the original version of this, but men in cowboy costumes, you know what I mean? Like that aren't from like Texas, you know?
You know, okay. I'm glad you brought it up because, like, with Be I'm really grateful for the Bastard Children stuff, and I'm so glad that I have songs on a Spotify playlist. I mean, that is incredible. That's, you know, it's a modest amount of money, but it's like, thank you, Goddess, that I have that. But, you know, the playlist is called Southern Gothic, and it's like I have like two songs that are like flirtations of that genre, and you know, it was different to me at the time when in the early 2010s when there was like a kind of a roots revival thing. But even then, I was like, I'm not from the South. I'm not gonna sing with an accent and wear like cowboy boots, and you know, it's a costume, and I really, it was interesting for a little bit because I'd never been around that before that. Like again, I was in rock bands and I liked, you know, alternative rock. And my go-to was always like the MTV Unplugged stuff and my early Mark Lanegan records was like that was my approach in my mind of like or how to approach things like doing acoustic music. But it was just I really got a bad taste in my mouth from that whole experience because of like some of the personalities and the sort of caricature of it. And it's just like, oh, okay, y'all or whatever, yeehaw. I don't know. It's just not authentic to me. Like I'm from North Providence. Like I don't have any business with that. It's talk about cultural appropriation. It's like how I feel when people like there's like so it's so popular to do this, but like when there's bands that like they do like the gypsy jazz thing or the gypsy punk thing, and I'm like they're not Romani people, and I'm like I have a personal grudge against that because my father was Romani, but.
There you
It's
go.
like, say, my grandfather grew up in a wagon, man. Like, you're just a gorger, but Anyways.
Yeah, it's really like you could almost do like an entire series on that, the appropriation of genres and, you know, and not even necessarily do it from like a precious social justice warrior standpoint, but
No,
more from
because
just like
you
a
know what?
scientific
Music doesn't,
standpoint.
because there is music that clearly is like inextricably linked to a particular culture. I don't want to sit here and say that nobody should be allowed to play that music and sing those kinds of songs if they don't belong to that culture. I don't think that's right, because artistically, you should feel free to do whatever you want. But at the same time, when it's not about whether or not someone can really genuinely love this music and want to play it, and they do it really well, and even if they didn't belong to that culture, it's like people who basically, it's a Halloween costume to some people. You know, it's like, it's just, there's nothing worse to me than inauthenticity. And that's, it transcends music. It's like, I can't stand that. There are people that, whose opinions I think I might agree with, but like, they're just so inauthentic to me. It's slimy. So it's like, I don't like them. You know, I don't like that. Like, they're just, you know, full of shit. It's like I can smell it.
No,
But
I'm
and
with you.
it's, you know, so yeah, I mean, the urban cowboy thing has been, it's time to put it away. It's like the comic book movies. We're all, you know, some of those are fun, but like, it's time to move on. Can we do some, explore something different? And like, for me personally, it's like, the second the album I put out immediately after Bastard Children, like the year I released it, I already started working on a new album with Household Items, which was like a love letter to like all the grunge I grew up on. I mean, I made it with my dad, who was the one who like used to throw me those tapes of Nirvana and Soundgarden. He's, you know, he had me playing guitar. I mean, he was a bass player, so it's like, it was a really special album to make, and I made it with my very good friend Alex Garzon, whom I'm working with again for this one. But you know, it was like, it was the antithesis to what I had done before, and like every subsequent release is, at least in my, I hope, is an attempt to try to explore something new or something different, or like, you know, kind of hammer away at something that I think I've got, you know, a good grasp on. So you know, that if it's successful, I mean, I hope it is, but like, I mean, we've been done this thing where like, I'm convinced, and I think I'm right, I have a theory that like, we would really do much better with like metal audiences, because it's dark music. And every, you know, one of the things that I noticed like early on was like, yeah, I'm playing acoustic guitar, and it's, you think it's singer-songwritery, but then like when you're listening to what I'm talking about in the songs, or the weird themes I'm think that are, I find interesting, it's like, I make some people uncomfortable, and it's like, well, this isn't really a good audience for this then. But it's, we played a Lovecraft, the Necronomicon, which is, you know, that brings together all kinds of weirdos, you know, people like me, dark culture people, whatever. But I was like, it was a really good show for us. Like, it was a very successful show for us. And it kind of proved my theory that like, those audiences will appreciate and understand what we're trying to do. And you know, then it's like, I discovered through some friends of mine who have turned me on to newer musicians that I never heard before, from like labels like Sergeant House and Sacred Bones. It's like, it's dark, it's heavy, but it's also sort of romantic and soft, and it's like, there's a gothic quality to it, but also folky, but also metal. And I noticed like, a lot of the audiences that go to those, that gravitate towards that, sort of intersect with like more of like the dark heavy metal audiences and so forth. So I'm like, I have a theory that like, we'd probably be much more appreciated by those kinds of audiences, I think.
I
I
think
could be
that makes
wrong.
sense. No, it
Because
definitely
I know
that makes sense.
yeah, and like, and we were talking about like mixed kind of genre of shows, which I would love to see more of. And I think Providence is, you know, it's a little stubborn about that. I think there, I don't know why it doesn't work so much. It should. I hope it does. And like, there should be no reason why you can't go to like a show with a metal band and something different. But then, you know, if you really just want to go to hear loud, fast, and that's more than understandable, then why would you want to hear something that's takes it down a peg or whatever?
Right. Now, it's an interesting concept that we'll see how it plays out. We have about 30 seconds left. I guess the best thing is, where can people find your music? Obviously Spotify, but is what, you know, what would you suggest people follow in terms of getting your current releases and then the next record that's coming out?
I make Voodoo Sister. Just make sure you spell it the right way. Exactly. V-U-D-U, Sister. Well, I just make sure that it's very, very good. It's on every platform, Spotify, Amazon, Bandcamp. I'm always telling people to go to Bandcamp, clearly, because all the money goes to the artists. But people don't like Bandcamp for some reason.
Yeah.
And Instagram, I'm very active on Instagram. I just started getting into TikTok. I hate it, but I'm just trying to be humble and accept that it's probably something I should be doing, I think. I don't know.
Yeah, but it's important, I guess, right?
We're just of that generation that kind of missed the boat on that one. But I'm always posting our shows. Always, like, if you go to Spotify or Bandcamp, the list of our next shows are on there. Facebook, obviously, Instagram. I have like images with the monthly schedule. So I'm pretty active on that. And so, it's not hard to find me.
Yeah. Heath McCurdy, Voodoo Sister. Thanks so much, man.
Thank you, Bill.
At HealthSource RI for Employers, we provide access to health insurance to more than 1,100 local businesses and nonprofits, and 96% of them renew through us every year. Maybe it's our choice of 19 different health plans, our 10 years of customizing solutions, or our one local team of dedicated experts helping employers find quality health insurance. See how our numbers stack up for you. Learn more at healthsourceri.com/employers.